Welcome back. In this lesson, we're exploring what data literacy is and why it matters. If you've watched the overview, this will build on that. If not, you'll still be able to follow along. Now, let's go further by exploring practical examples, future workplace relevance, responsible use, and how you can build confidence with this skill.
Yeah, and it really is such an essential foundation for, well, pretty much everything we do now.
Right, because I mean, we're operating in this environment where basically every single action you take generates this permanent digital record.
Exactly. And interpreting that record, it's just no longer optional. It's a survival skill.
It really is. Like, to put this into perspective for you, just imagine a scenario at, say, a major tech company.
Okay.
So the product team, they launched this highly anticipated software update, right? Mm-hmm. And within a week, their primary performance metric, which is average time spent on the app, it just spikes by like 300%.
Oh, wow. So they're thrilled.
Oh, completely. The executive team starts popping champagne. I mean, they think they've just built the most engaging feature in the entire company's history.
Right, because the number went up.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
But then a month later, user retention just completely plummets and like thousands of customers are canceling their subscriptions.
Let me guess. Because nobody actually bothered to ask how that time was being spent.
Spot on. When they finally dug into the actual user feedback, they realized the new interface was just so incredibly poorly designed that users were spending like triple the amount of time just trying to figure out how to log out.
Oh my gosh, that's brutal.
Right. And the crazy thing is, the numbers were entirely accurate. The app usage time had indeed spiked.
But the translation of that raw number, you know, turning it into a narrative about human behavior was catastrophically wrong.
Exactly. I mean, that is a multi-million dollar failure caused entirely by weak data literacy.
Yeah, it's a brilliant example. The people in that room, they likely understood the math, right? But they completely failed to interrogate the context.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because when we talk about data literacy, the baseline definition we're using in this lesson is the ability to read, understand, interpret, question, and communicate data.
Right. And I think a major hurdle here is just the word itself. When people hear data, they still picture this archaic, headache-inducing spreadsheet with like 50,000 rows of tiny numbers.
Oh, totally. We tend to equate data with, I don't know, high-level mathematics or computer science?
Yeah, but data is simply recorded information. It's just information collected for analysis or decision-making.
Which used to be really hard to get. Like, historically, we had to go out of our way to collect it, right?
Oh, yeah. Running clipboards around a shopping mall to survey people, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But today.
Yeah.
Today, data is just the, well, the passive exhaust of our digital lives.
That's a great way to put it.
It's the number of steps your smartwatch logs or, you know, the swipe patterns on a mobile site or even just the transactional metadata from buying a coffee.
Because the barrier to collecting all that information has just completely collapsed. Computing power is so cheap now. But what hasn't kept pace is our collective ability to actually interpret it.
Right.
Whether you are a university student synthesizing research or a young professional walking into your first major corporate strategy meeting, data is basically the default language of modern workplace readiness.
So let's talk about the consequences of being illiterate in that language. Mm. I like to compare having weak data literacy to trying to navigate a sprawling, rapidly changing metropolis using a map drawn in the 1990s.
Oh, that's a really good analogy.
Right, because the geography is technically there, but, well, the one-way streets have changed, they've built new highways, and if you trust that outdated map blindly,
you are going to drive your car straight into a concrete wall.
Exactly.
Yeah, because when you lack the heuristics to filter out the noise in this complex digital environment, you inevitably fall back on your cognitive biases.
You just kind of go with your gut.
Right. You start making poor decisions because you just accept misleading information at face value, simply because it's presented with a fancy percentage sign next to it.
Yeah. And in a professional setting, that leads to incredibly fragile arguments.
And a fragile argument in a boardroom is a massive career hazard.
Oh, for sure. If you are proposing a major budget shift and your primary evidence is just your personal intuition, experienced executives will dismantle your proposal in seconds.
Yeah, you move from a position of authority to a position of pleading.
Exactly. But strong data literacy completely inverts that dynamic.
It really does. When you can read the digital landscape accurately, it acts as this this amplifier for your critical thinking and problem-solving skills.
Yeah, because you aren't just reciting numbers. You are actively extracting an insight.
Yes, insight. That term is the ultimate goal here.
An insight is a useful, actionable understanding that you actually gain from analyzing the information.
Right.
I actually find it helpful to think about the relationship between data and insight, like the relationship between crude oil and aviation fuel.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, because crude oil is a highly valuable raw material, obviously. But if you pour a barrel of raw crude oil straight into the engine of a commercial jet,
you're going to destroy the engine.
Exactly. You aren't going to fly anywhere. The raw material has to be meticulously refined and filtered and processed before it becomes the combustible fuel that actually propels the plane forward.
So the data is the crude oil.
And the insight is the fuel.
That refining process is where the actual value is created. It's the intellectual labor of looking at a raw metric, combining it with your contextual business knowledge, and then producing a clear directive on what the team should actually do next.
So, okay, if we want to build that refining process, what does the architectural blueprint look like? How do you actually do this in your day-to-day life?
Well, there's a four-step framework for this workflow that serves as a really fantastic toolkit.
All right, let's go through it.
First, you ask what the data is explicitly showing. Second, you interrogate where the data came from. Third, you look for objective patterns and trends. And fourth, you actively avoid jumping to conclusions.
Okay, those first three make total sense, but I do want to push back on that fourth step, though.
Okay, go ahead.
Especially regarding workplace realities. Because avoid jumping to conclusions sounds great in a classroom, right?
Sure.
But in a high-stakes corporate environment, speed is often prioritized over absolute peer-reviewed accuracy.
Whoa, absolutely.
Like, say you're an analyst, and the VP of sales demands to know why regional revenue dropped this week. And you have exactly 2 hours before the board meeting. You don't have the luxury of spending a month interrogating every possible missing variable.
No, you don't.
Sometimes you just have to make a leap to meet a deadline. So how do you balance the need for speed with the necessity of accuracy?
That is the reality of the modern workplace. What's fascinating here is that you are often dealing with what economists call bounded rationality.
Bounded rationality.
Yeah, it basically means making the best decision possible with limited time and incomplete information. The goal isn't to conduct a PhD-level defense every time you look at a chart.
Right.
The goal is to perform a rapid sanity check to avoid catastrophic errors. And you do this by aggressively hunting for the most obvious confounding variables.
Okay, let's ground that in a specific example. What does hunting for a confounding variable actually look like when the clock is ticking?
Okay, imagine a company launches a massive, super expensive new loyalty program on a Tuesday.
Okay.
By Friday, their customer churn rate, which is the rate at which people are canceling their service, has just plummeted.
So cancellations are way down.
Right. The marketing team immediately jumps to the conclusion that their loyalty program is a massive success. They're correlating the launch of the program with the drop in cancellations.
Right. They see two events happening simultaneously and assume one caused the other. Classic causation versus correlation.
Exactly. But what the raw data dashboard doesn't show is that on Wednesday, their biggest regional competitor filed for bankruptcy and completely shut down their servers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The customers didn't stay because of the new loyalty points. They stayed because they literally had nowhere else to go.
So that's the omitted variable bias.
Precisely. The rapid sanity check in that scenario isn't spending weeks doing complex regression analysis. It's simply pausing to ask, hey, what external event could also explain this sudden shift?
Because you have to actively fight your own confirmation bias. I mean, the marketing team wanted the loyalty program to work, so they just instantly accepted the first metric that validated their effort.
And that takes a lot of discipline. It requires you to act as an objective observer of your own business rather than a cheerleader for your own projects.
Let's transition this mindset into a very practical, everyday scenario to highlight how this builds workplace readiness. Think about a university student working on a final presentation.
Yeah.
If they stand up in front of the lecture hall and say, I believe our campus needs more late-night study spaces. I mean, that is easily discussed. It's purely anecdotal.
Right. It's just an opinion.
But if they say, I surveyed 500 students across four different departments, and 82% reported they are entirely unable to find adequate seating in the library after 8:00 p.m., well, the entire dynamic of the room shifts.
Yeah. They compel the audience to listen.
Exactly.
Now, fast forward 3 years. That same individual is, let's say, 6 months into their first major role as a supply chain analyst.
Okay.
And they need to convince a room of senior directors to drop a legacy vendor and switch to a new supplier. If they rely on anecdotal complaints about the current vendor, the executives will just tear the proposal apart.
But if they bring the receipts, so to speak?
Yes. If they confidently pull up historical performance metrics, demonstrate that the current vendor has a 15% higher late delivery rate during peak seasons, and then translate how that specific delay costs the company $50,000 a quarter in lost sales, they instantly build bulletproof credibility.
Yeah.
They transition from being a junior employee expressing an opinion to a strategic asset driving a real business decision.
And this is exactly where practical digital tools become your best friend. Because we aren't just talking about reading data. We're talking about communicating it.
Absolutely.
Tools like Google Sheets, Microsoft Excel, and visualization platforms like DataWrapper are the everyday instruments used to construct these arguments. But it's not just about dumping a spreadsheet full of raw numbers onto a PowerPoint slide.
No, please don't do that.
Right. It's about the psychology of visual communication.
That is such a critical point, because if you put a table of 500 numbers in front of a senior executive, you are forcing their brain to burn enormous amounts of cognitive energy just to figure out what they're looking
at. And making them do the work.
And you completely lose control of the narrative.
Let's take a pie chart versus a heat map. A lot of people just default to pie charts.
They really do.
But if you have like 12 different data points in a pie chart, the human eye is actually biologically terrible at judging subtle differences in angles in two-dimensional area.
Right.
So the boardroom will just end up arguing over whether the blue slice is slightly bigger than the red slice.
Yeah, you've inadvertently created confusion because of a poor visualization choice.
But if you take that exact same data and put it into a geographical heat map using, say, DataWrapper, where the regions with failing delivery times are shaded in dark saturated crimson and the healthy regions are light gray, well, our brains process that color saturation in milliseconds.
Yeah.
Before you even open your mouth to speak, the entire room is instantly aligned on exactly where the problem is.
That is the essence of strong data literacy in practice. You remove the friction from the communication process. You aren't just doing the math. You are facilitating the executive decision.
But, you know, with that level of persuasive power comes a really significant ethical responsibility.
Oh, definitely.
We've focused heavily on how to use data to win the argument and build your career. But the unavoidable flip side is that if you can persuade people with data, other people can and will use data to persuade you.
And they won't always do it, honestly.
Right.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we operate in a fast-paced digital society where information is literally weaponized for engagement.
Yep.
You are scrolling through a social media feed and you encounter a chart that perfectly validates your worldview or your political leanings or a lifestyle choice you just made. And the friction required to hit that share button is practically zero.
It's so easy.
It is alarmingly easy to become a node in a network of misinformation simply because we refuse to pause and question the source.
I actually refer to this as the sleek chart phenomenon.
Oh, I like that.
Because we have this deeply ingrained cognitive bias that equates high production value with high factual accuracy. The halo effect, right?
Exactly.
If a chart is beautifully designed with, you know, sleek typography, modern color palettes, smooth animations, our brains subconsciously assume the underlying data must be equally rigorous and professional.
Which is a very dangerous assumption.
Very.
True critical thinking requires you to look past the aesthetic presentation and interrogate the methodology. You have to ask the mechanical questions, like who funded this research? What was the actual sample size?
Yeah, let's drill down into that mechanism of sample size, because it's a trap people fall into daily. Why does a survey of 10 people versus 10,000 people entirely change the mathematical reality of an insight?
Well, it comes down to the law of large numbers and the margin of error. If you flip a standard coin four times, it is entirely possible to get heads three times.
Right.
That's 75%. If you stop the experiment there, you might publish a sleek chart claiming that this specific coin has a heavy bias toward heads.
But intuitively, we know a coin is 50-50.
Right. And if you flip that same coin 10,000 times, the anomalies wash out and the result will settle incredibly close to 50%.
Exactly.
So when you see a chart making a bold, definitive claim, but the methodology reveals they only surveyed 12 people, Well, the data hasn't stabilized. It's mathematically meaningless.
But if it's wrapped in a pretty graphic, it gets shared thousands of times.
Thousands.
Another mechanism of manipulation is the leading question.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if a company wants to generate a marketing graphic showing high customer satisfaction, they might survey their users.
Yeah.
But if the question is phrased as, how much do you love the innovative new features in our latest update?
Mm-hmm.
They have mathematically manipulated the baseline. They're forcing the user to agree with the premise that the features are innovative and lovable before they even answer.
Compare that to a neutral, objectively phrased question like, please rate your experience with the latest update on a scale of 1 to 10.
Totally different.
The data generated by the first question is fundamentally compromised. Responsibility means recognizing that data is not some infallible objective force of nature. It is a human artifact.
It's made by people.
Right. It is collected by humans, organized by humans, and presented by humans. And humans have biases, financial agendas, and sometimes they simply make calculation errors.
So how do you actively build a cognitive firewall against this? How do you do the listener develop this muscle so that questioning data becomes a subconscious reflex rather than a tedious chore?
Well, like any future skill, it requires consistent, low-stakes repetition. You don't learn this by cramming for a test. You learn it by changing your daily consumption habits.
Okay, here's a highly practical growth activity you can start today. It's essentially a micro habit.
I love micro habits.
Right. So the next time you are scrolling on your phone, reading a newsletter, or reviewing a report for a project, and you encounter a chart or a statistical claim, I want you to force a 3-second pause.
Just stop for 3 seconds.
Stop the scroll and verbally identify 3 specific things.
It's a powerful pattern interrupt.
First, ask, what is this explicitly showing? Look at the X and Y axis. What do the colors actually represent? What is the literal stated claim?
Okay.
Second, ask the hardest question. What is this not showing? What context has been cropped out of the frame? Are they omitting a critical variable like our competitor going bankrupt in the loyalty program example?
Yeah, that's the big one.
And third, based on those 2 answers, what is one actual defensible insight you can extract?
I strongly encourage you to approach this exercise with genuine curiosity rather than viewing it as a math test you are going to fail.
Yeah, it shouldn't be stressful.
Exactly. When you start regularly identifying the missing context, you completely stop being a passive consumer of the digital world. You become an active critical participant. It demystifies the information. You replace the feeling of being overwhelmed by statistics with the satisfaction of solving a puzzle.
And when you realize that every dashboard, every infographic, and every spreadsheet is just a narrative waiting for you to verify its plot holes, it actually becomes incredibly engaging.
It really does. It fundamentally rewires how you interact with professional and public information.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a core reflection prompt. Carry this question with you as you navigate your week. How can I use data to make better, more defensible academic, personal, or professional decisions today?
Keep that question right at the forefront of your mind. We want to encourage you to stay endlessly curious, be highly responsible consumers of the information you share, and remain future ready. The digital tools and the workplace landscapes, well, they'll constantly shift, but the foundational ability to extract truth from noise will always make you adaptable. And lifelong learning is the absolute core of that adaptability.
Spot on. And for your immediate next steps, we highly encourage you to review the end of module study guide and actively complete the workbook activities. Listening to this conversation is a great start, but doing the practical exercises is how you permanently lock this knowledge into your cognitive toolkit.
The transition from passive theory to an active skill happens in the practice.
We also want to make sure we acknowledge the essential reference materials that form the backbone of these concepts. If you want to explore these ideas further, we highly recommend checking out Data Literacy Fundamentals by Ben Jones, which was published in 2020. Also, the incredible book Factfulness by Hans Rosling from 2018, and Storytelling with Data by Cole Nussbaumer-Naflick, published in 2015.
Oh, they are transformative resources. They will completely alter how you perceive the numbers communicating the world around you. They're basically required reading for anyone serious about building lasting digital confidence.
Thank you so much for joining us for this session. It has been fantastic guiding you through this material. Just remember, the next time you find yourself dropped into that complex, rapidly changing metropolis of digital information,
you no longer have to wander aimlessly.
You have the map. Now, go use it to build something great.